All right, everyone. Welcome back to That's Criminal with yours truly. It has been a great couple of first couple of weeks as a new podcast guy running That's Criminal. Spent some time talking to some amazing people, and that is not going to end anytime soon, especially today. Today, I'm going to chat with Robin Maharaj. Robin is looking at her bio, kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to the writer's life. I'm pretty excited. There's a lot of different avenues we can talk about here. But just briefly to introduce her, Robin's a freelance journalist, a grant writer, former arts director. She's based in Canada. She co-founded a couple writers festivals. She's been published in magazines, poetry, which is something I have never been able to do. Does book and film reviews in numerous different newspapers, magazines, literary journals. Two poems published via anthologies. And 2014, I guess she got the true crime bug and wrote for Crime Magazine an article based on Jeffrey Dahmer. And then she met Detective Pat Kennedy, and the two collaborated on the interrogation of Jeffrey Dahmer, from arrest to the moment they identified all 17 of his victims. And her and Pat put it all down on paper in a book called Grilling Dahmer. So I'm very excited. Thank you very much, Robin, for joining me.
Well, thanks, John.
Yep. So Grilling Dahmer. I don't understand poetry. I've tried. I've read it. I've tried it. Anybody who can do that, can manage that small of a frame to get those down with that kind of organization, amazes me. I can't even write a short story. So
right. It definitely is a genre that it has sort of a smaller audience, and a smaller maybe an appreciation of it. But it really is coming down to word. You really are sort of managing every word you're putting down on the page, because there is usually so few of them. But yeah, I love to read poetry, and I love to write it. But I really don't write it too much these days. I have to get back into it, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. Just anybody who can do that kind of organizing and sequencing with words, that is outside of my skill set. So I guess we could talk books, because I can relate. Yeah. Grilling Dahmer. As we were talking about before we started recording, as a former agent and a police officer, reading this book just showed, just the sophistication of Detective Kennedy, and just his way of reading people and just walking through, like I said, it's just an anatomy of an interview and interrogation. And I can't wait to dive into it. But if you'd like to let us know how this came about, because like I said, freelance journalist, grant writer, poet, and then you're like, I'm going to start to try the true crime gig. So how did you make that jump?
Because you work as a freelance writer, you tend to get bombarded, especially when you're starting out. You get bombarded with all kinds of different assignments. And if you're young and you have the energy to kind of tackle any subject and kind of research it and go out and talk to people who are about that subject and then, research and write it all down, it takes a lot of energy, and you sort of feel like you're all over the place. And as I was getting older and developing as a writer, I guess, I thought, I don't want to use my time now to write things that I'm really interested in. And I love true crime. I mean, I love documentaries and series on television, investigation, discovery, all of those kind of true crime series. I love true crime books, obviously, magazine articles, the whole bit. So I thought, I'm going to just try my hand at this and see how that goes, if I can become a reader of the genre and actually try my hand at writing it. So I decided to write an article about Jeffrey Dahmer, because I just kind of felt like he was one that hadn't really had that much study about him. There had been a few books that had come out, but I kind of felt like we didn't really know that much about him. We sort of knew all about his crimes, and he had, the Milwaukee Cannibal label attached to him, the Monster of Milwaukee, et cetera. But I sort of thought, what about the guy? Like, what about the actual man, Dahmer? So I went about kind of researching his life and looking at different documentaries on him. And of course, Pat Kennedy featured pretty prominently in those because he was the lead detective on the Dahmer investigation. And through a connection with one of the films, the documentaries that he was in, I had contacted the director just through email and he put me in touch with Pat. So he became a great resource for the article that I did write. And we met in Madison, Wisconsin in 2013. This would have been in April of 2013. And so we, over the course of our discussion, and I think what he was impressed about was not only did I have, you know, writing and editing experience, because he had been sort of dabbling with some of his reports and some of the notes and things, but he just didn't feel like he could make the jump to turning it into a workable manuscript. And I was offering to help him to do that. But I think what impressed him about the idea of possibly working with him was that I wasn't really interested in the gore and the sort of salaciousness of the gory details of the story. I was really more interested in Jeff. And so I think based on that, he said, you know what, let me give you my stuff to look at and then we'll go from there. So he gave me all of his materials and I was actually in the process of reading them. And then after that night, we had our dinner and interview. 5 days later, Kennedy had a heart attack and passed away. He had a fatal heart attack. And so I was kind of left like, oh my God, I was right in the middle of reading this man's work and all of a sudden he's dead. And we had just had dinner like 5 nights earlier. So it was just a real shock. But anyways, I went ahead and I did the article and I submitted it and then I sent it to his widow, Patricia. And so she was the one that said, you know, this is, you know, you did a really good job on this article. Why don't you just work with the manuscript? You know, I know you're working or planning to collaborate with Pat, but she said, maybe you should just go ahead and do it. Because otherwise, she said, like, I don't know what to do with it. So she said, it'll just end up back in his desk drawer. And I just thought, oh, that can't happen. This is, you know, such a compelling story on so many levels. So I just kind of ran with it. And then thus became the book.
Yeah. And as you lay it out that way, you know, the amazing thing is, there's a whole lot of humility in what you say, because grilling Dahmer, you take second stage to you give the attribution right on the cover to Mr. Kennedy, and it's Patrick Kennedy and Robin. It's kind of interesting when you say that, because you put it all together, but you still gave him top billing, which was, you know, that's a very nice aspect. You know, that's not everybody would do that. So
it was his story, you know, absolutely his story. And I just wanted to be the one to kind of help put it out there. Yeah.
That's a great thing. That's a great attribution to that. But I think you guys really sell it in the book. Cause yeah, you don't go into, I mean, I think you're right in that Dahmer, people can't get past the gore of what he did, because there's plenty of it, and you know the headlines don't want to dive too deep, so they can get all the, you know, the all the attention can go to the viciousness, but the way Kennedy's notes were and the way you laid it all out just showed his expertise in humanity from the start. Because what I noticed, and I'll let you go back in a minute, but it wasn't about that. Whenever they mentioned those gory details, it was based on the interrogation. It wasn't somebody taking artistic license with, you know, trying to make it more brutal than it was. It was Jeff explaining to Kennedy, you know, all the deepest, darkest secrets, and the way he was capturing that and the way he was able to elicit that. So you guys nailed it on not dwelling on that, on the horror side of it, but actually getting to who that guy was. And there were parts in the book you're just like, man, this, I bet, you know, the guy wasn't, you know, he was pretty functional. He was a pretty functional human being. He just had a real dark side, you know?
That's right. Very warped personality.
Yep. But yet, so the, what, when, like we were talking about the anatomy of this interrogation, you guys started off really right with, you know, them getting the call. It's just a normal everyday night, and like 10:30 at night they get the call to go respond to this. I think when they were given the call, him and his partner was get over to this, we got some weird stuff going on. And as he shows up, three cops are all sweaty and torn up because this guy put up so much of a fight. They're still sitting there, you know, holding him down in the middle of his apartment. And Kennedy, you know, he's low man on the totem pole, told to transport him down and get him in the box and start talking to him. And the way he did that, I mean, that's, you know, it's not, unfortunately, thanks to TV, everybody always thinks you go, you know, if you got somebody dead bang like that, there's a head in the guy's fridge. TV would say, you know, you go hard on him and you got him, you know, and you just, you know, browbeat the guy into a confession, and it never works that way. It's the people who can turn on that empathy, that really, you know, nail it and become those experts. And you guys have a part where he, you know, does a quick profile of what he sees sitting across the table from him, and then finds mm-hmm. those themes, builds a rapport, treats them like a human being. Mm-hmm. How did you guys mm-hmm. discuss that? Was there much discussion as far as that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, Kennedy at that time, back in 1991, was, I guess, 37 years old. And, you know, had come to become, you know, a police officer, you know, kind of because of his dad. You know, his dad had that job, so he was very used to the life of what it was like to have a cop in the family, if you were. And so he, when we talked about that part of it, you know, it was really just that, you know, he always, no matter how grievous the crimes you think that the person, the suspect might have done, you know, it's basically like got to kind of connect with the person as a human being. And he, you know, sort of said, I've seen other cops, you know, where they got to go in and play the tough guy, and they just sort of determine that they're going to gain control of the room and be the power force in the room. And he said, it's never in his mind about the power. Like, obviously, you know, he's the one that, and as he said, you know, he had his cop by his, his revolver still on him, and he didn't even realize it. I guess, you know, just the excitement and the adrenaline of the night. But, you know, like, he kind of disarmed himself, as he would with any other suspect afterwards. But he came back in the room and he just said, you know, it's too easy to call this guy a monster. It's just way too easy just to say, you know, there's something wrong with him. Let's just, you know, throw him in a cage. We need to find out who his victims are, how far this goes back, you know, who were these people. And the only way you're really going to do that is to establish a rapport. And that's going to mean, you know, asking him, do you want a cigarette? Can I get you a sandwich? How about a cup of coffee? You know, let's get you comfortable before we start to have a conversation about what was going on in your apartment and why we found a severed head in your fridge. And, you know, who was that man? And are there others? And what about these other photographs we saw, the other cops saw, that were in your apartment? You know, like, we got to, there's a lot going on here, a lot to unpack. So we need to get him to trust us, first of all. I think that was, you know, going to be the first thing. Jeff didn't have a bad relationship with authority. In fact, he was actually quite a deferential personality. So very much yes, sir, no, sir. And in fact, his encounters with police previously had always been very positive. You know, he'd always managed to talk his way out of things. And to some extent, I think there was a little of that maybe going on in the room in the very beginning. He thought, well, I know it looks really bad for myself, but maybe I can talk my way out of this. But once he realized they were going through his apartment and they were, you know, starting, there was actually a whole team of people there, you know, he still managed to decide, okay, well, I better come clean. And at that moment, Kennedy was his friend. Because he was saying, yeah, you know, like, I'm not here to judge you. I just want to talk to you. I want to hear your story.
Yep. Yeah. He went at it, you know, the way you guys wrote it, Dahmer's spinning. I mean, once he told him, mm-hmm. you know, we're at your apartment, we're going through your room right now. And he just started spinning, you know, trying to work the, you know, trying to do the suicide by cop thing, just kill me now, blah, 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 blah. He had a plan mm-hmm. of how he wanted to go out. It wasn't working for him. But, you know, Kennedy just saw the opportunity and A, treated him like a human, B, gave him a hook. He gave him a lifeline and yeah. made, when he offered that theme of redemption, whether Dahmer believed him or not, whether he was looking for redemption or not, he saw the hook and he saw the opportunity. And Kennedy just nailed it, and he just built it with him right there. But he treated him like a human, and he went in real soft and real easy. And it was just treating a human being like they're supposed to be treated, regardless of the fact that in the first minute we met, I found a head in your fridge. We'll get to that. but first off, how are you feeling? You know?
Yeah.
So that got me right from the start, just because I, and it made me think of a particular guy, first week working with him. And we didn't know each other real well. We hit it off real good. And we pull a case together, And he goes in to start the interrogation. He's the biggest, burliest dude you would not want to see coming at you. He goes in and he turns into an absolute teddy bear and just has this person in his hands, just big teddy bear. And the guy's just telling him his life story within about 10 minutes. And I was like, he was one of those people where when they go in the room, you want to bring a notebook and you want to sit outside and watch and take notes to figure out how to be a better interrogator. And that's I saw the same thing when we started reading about this interrogation. The thing was, whenever they'd break, he'd go out into the bullpen and he'd just start taking barbs from all the older, more established detectives that were out there. But he also, you could see him how they switched that. Was there any discussion between you two about the dichotomy of his position?
I guess it was a little bit later on. Like, he would often talk about, you know, while the trial was on, because at that point, and Kennedy was, you know, the first night, you know, no one really outside of the police and his own friends and family, you know, knew who Kennedy was in terms of the relation to his work. But by the time that the trial was on, and his picture was in the paper all the time, side by side with Dahmer's, I think then a lot of his colleagues would rib him, you know, and give him like a hard time and say, oh, you know, your boyfriend's on the stand again, or whatever, you know, like whatever. They give him a hard time, or they clip out the two pictures and put hearts all around it, that kind of thing. And he said, yeah. And he said, you know, part of that is, you know, it's just the camaraderie of the way cops are sometimes, and also just to kind of lighten the intensity of it all. What he did say about that first night, though, a lot, I mean, there was some of that ribbing going on. And maybe that was, in a way, professional jealousy. Who knows? Like, it's like, wow, that was, it's a case to catch, you know, in terms of a career-making a criminal or a serial killer. I mean, that's sort of like an echelon, maybe, that other cops around him were kind of, gee, I wish I had taken this call. Who knows? The real thing that he said was going on was that every time he left the room, they were filling him in. We found this now. This is what we found. We've done a background check on this, and this is what we've learned. You know, his father's been aware, you know, like, so he would go out and he'd just get more information about Jeff, as well as what they were finding in the apartment. So in a way, you know, here he's trying to build this rapport, be nice, you know, be trying to befriend the guy. And every time he's coming back into the room, he's learned this much more about some of the horrors that were going on in that apartment. So Kennedy to be able to kind of keep that level-headedness, that ability to sort of say, okay, I'm still going to kind of continue. And I think too, like, as the evening progressed, the night progressed, and he realized that, like, this is a guy who's coming down from having been drinking all night earlier, and he's now starting to sober up. And, you know, it's coming clear that he's, you know, starting to understand the severity of the situation that he's in. Again, you know, Kennedy kind of said, you know, I can relate to him on this level because I'm a recovering alcoholic. And so I think that, again, became another way he could kind of, you know, kind of get into Jeff's trust, in terms of, you know, sort of saying, like, there's nothing you can tell me that's going to shock me, or nothing that's going to, you can tell me that I'm going to judge you about, because that's not my job. He said, my job is just to take down your story and tell for you to tell me as much as you can. And I think he was really, Kennedy, I mean, very curious about how could someone become like this, you know? And then that sort of goes off. And this is something we talked about a lot in the interview, is like the subjects of loneliness and being bullied as a young person, you know? And these are all things that I think even today we can very much relate to with young people. And so I mean, I think there was a curiosity about Kennedy that he, you know, it wasn't just about, okay, this could be the career making case. I think it was really more about, I want to find out, like, what made this guy tick.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the opportunity alone to, because that first night he's by himself, like, his partner is working the scene. And so it's just him and Dahmer in that interrogation. And like you said, every time he goes out, they're like, you're not going to believe what we found. Let me show you this.
Yeah, there's a circus going on outside. Media is starting to descend. Yeah. You know, hazmat trucks, guys in big white suits, you know, showing up. And Kennedy's in the room along with this guy, you know, and learning all about this in sort of trickles, you know, like little trickles of information.
Yeah, and every bit worse than the last. But this, you know, he's learning it while he's, hey, can I go get you a cup of coffee? You know, cream, two sugars, you know, what else? You know, would you like a pillow for your seat? You know, let's take the time to get to know each other, you know, and then they're like, Yeah, he spray painted skulls. Oh, okay. I forgot. Yeah, you know, he needs. Yeah, you know, I forgot it was two sugars. You know. Yeah. I'm gonna file this part away, and I'm gonna go back in and talk to this guy and continue to build that rapport. Taking on that role of an advocate too was just a move that just showed offering that lifeline again. Like, you know, he wasn't lying to anybody. It's like, you know, Jeff, you're gonna pay for this, but I can help you, you know, I can help you tell your story. Being an advocate, even in that base nature adversarial relationship, the guy had just gotten beaten up while he's taken into custody. And there's another guy with the same badge saying, I can help you with this. And for him to say that right at the right time, like that Dahmer needed that thread of hope. He just marvelously just worked that interrogation just from, you know, piece to piece. And again, all by himself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I appreciate what you said there too, you know, like he was being honest with him. He wasn't lying to him. They weren't deceiving him, but they were delivering, you know, the reality of it, which is, you know, like, yeah, Jeff, you know, there's going to be some consequences here, but, you know, let's just do what we can. And, you know, he convinced Dahmer, I think, to sort of put into words the statement of like, I can do now is just try to help identify who these men are, you know? And that's really what that most majority of their time together was, by the way, about just doing just that. But I mean, you know, when I read about other people and their encounters with Dahmer, particularly his father, Lionel, would always say, you know, if he was ever in a situation where he was being confronted by an authority, like a police officer, you know, his thing would be to talk his way as much as he could or shut down. And I think once he realized, you know, I'm not going to be able to talk my way out of this one, you know, it would have been so easy for Dahmer just to shut down. You know, that would have been his next instinct, I think. But there was just something about Kennedy that he liked, and he wanted to please Kennedy, you know, as the time they've been together went on. You know, he really wanted to please Kennedy. He didn't want to make Kennedy upset or mad, you know, so there was a real friendship there. I almost called it like, you know, maybe it was the older brother that Dahmer never had, you know, in a way, because they weren't really that much of an age difference. You know, he was 31, I think, when he was caught, and Kennedy was only 37 as a homicide detective. So.
Yeah, relatively new, but that was, I think, you know, when he got him to bite on the redemption theme, that, you know, directly led to the next couple months, you know, up until the trial date, was that working through, you know, tons and tons of mugshots and books and trying to get the story and the timeline down. But they, as they were doing that, you know, they were never really asking him why. They stuck to the theme, and the why came out basically out of Dahmer himself as they were talking. It just naturally started coming, especially when they worked their way back in the timeline to the first ones. Yeah. And as he grew, as far as his methodology grew, there was even a point that I highlighted when he realized exactly when his when he was able to separate from his consciousness and admitted that it was just selfishness of what he wanted out of these men. And he didn't, it didn't matter, you know, what anybody else was in the end. And then the gruesome part was more methodology and disposal than it was, you know, there was that weird fascination, but it came out of the expediency of getting rid of the evidence. Right. At least that was my take. So it was a very deep read, and like I said, just the anatomy of seeing that go was just he gave him that lifeline, and then you know, and then they wanted to hand off the case to their, you know, their day shift star, and the day shift star couldn't get through the front door with Dahmer, and that was just after one that first night. So just put him on that stage to stick with it. And as a former FBI agent, I thought it was pretty funny how they showed those guys the door too. Because I would guarantee you, if I was on the job in 1991, that I probably would have tried to steal that case too. But it is funny. Yeah. Not to shift gears too much, because I just the way he handled his technique during that interrogation was amazing. But you mentioned the, you know, getting into the true crime aspect, and as I was reading, I'm always trying to to remember when did this, you know, insanity that we now have as a culture about true crime really take off. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I mean, I know like Douglas's Mindhunter came out like in 95, I think, when everybody suddenly wanted to be an FBI profiler.
Silence of the Lambs.
And even up to like 2 years ago, you know, you get an intern and it's like, oh, so what do you want to do when you get out of college? Oh, I'm going to go be an FBI profiler. Like, you're really not. You're not going to do that. I don't want to do this to you.
Maybe the armchair profiler, but yeah, not as a living necessarily.
There's a process for that, kiddo.
I think it's just that people find it so fascinating. Like, I think they would find the work so fascinating, and how that, you know, and I have to admit it, like, I'm not that I would at my age turn around and say, oh, this is suddenly what I'd like to do. But man, those shows where they kind of can figure out, you know, this is sort of the personality that you're going to be looking for in terms of this kind of crime. Like, ah, so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and the statistical way that they went about doing the VICAP, you know, studies, going in and just talking to these people over and over again was fantastic. Yeah. But what got me was, okay, so this is 1991, 92, and it seems like, if I got my timeline right, but it seemed like that was the first, the time of our first Gulf War, and that was really like, you know, we're watching that on TV every night. That was the first war that was on prime time for everybody to see every aspect of it. And really, it kind of seemed like Dahmer just came at that right time to be the first guy that we get to watch go through court TV. You know, every aspect of him is going to be filmed. So I wonder if, I can't remember what the catalyst was that really kicked this stuff off, but it was such a big shock, I think, to the culture to see, be like, oh, this guy's been eating people and he lives in an apartment building, you know?
Right, exactly. I think it's exactly around that time of the Gulf War, because what was happening in the news at that time in terms of journalism was these 24-hour news stations. And so they had to fill, you know, 24 hours of content. And of course, some of it is repeating stories, but I mean, they really needed to kind of go beyond in terms of finding stories to report about. And, you know, true crime in terms of, I mean, if you think of your daily paper, you know, back in the days when you'd get a newspaper in hand, you know, I mean, you focus on the politics, you focus on the economy, you focus on your healthcare system, school, whatever. But I mean, there's always going to be the crime section in terms of, you know, what's going on in that. And I think people just are naturally drawn to the dark side of life sometimes, you know, whether we like to admit it or not. I think we are drawn to that sometimes. I mean, I'm always fascinated in just in terms of the people, you know, and how people get caught and, you know, sort of the interesting little things that can occur. I don't know if you've caught the latest Netflix John Wayne Gacy story, and I don't want to get off on a topic about him, but I mean, if you really think about, you know, all the stuff that they uncovered there and how they were finally got to get Gacy, it was because of this little, you know, slip from a like when a girl had put in her photos to get them developed, and she had put it in the pocket of the victim, who then later was abducted essentially by Gacy. And that was what they used to get the search warrant to get into his house the second time. And that's when they were starting to realize that, you know, this guy is burying boys in his basement, you know? So, but it's those little things that's like, what a fascinating story, you know? And if they didn't have that, would they have actually caught the guy, you know?
And in this case, we get, you know, their conversations, we got to walk right through that with how he ended up getting caught. Cause I mean, he's very organized if you look at it, that first one, when he's like 18 years old, very organized way of going about, you know, a relatively accidental murder, you know, but stomping up the bones and separating them, you know, tossing them around in the, you know, in the woods, you know, to the screw up on his next one where he had to go out and buy some luggage, you know, suddenly, very, very suddenly. But then he just looked at it. And as he grew, his organization, his methodology became pretty much flawless over time. Yeah. But he even admitted that when that guy, at the point where the guy escaped him, because that's how he got caught, you know, a guy escapes with a funky pair of handcuffs on and the police bring him back to get the key off. But at the time he admits he's got a dead guy on his bed. He was too hammered to actually control his victim. And then he's got another one, like, you know, melting in a vat of acid or something like that. And so he was so spun. He just spun. I mean, he went from very, very organized to that life and that pressure getting Yeah, he just lost it, and he lost his. He veered from his methodology, and that was it. And basically, because of the alcoholism, looks like.
That's right. I think he just was spiraling out of control at the end, and getting very sloppy, and actually it was increasing in the number of victims. And so he was picking up new victims when he hadn't actually disposed completely of the last victim. And you're right. You know, he was drinking way more. He was staying home from work a lot more. And he'd actually been fired, you know, so his world was really spiraling out of control when they actually caught him.
Yep. Yeah. Just, he's trying to, I mean, just feeding that urge. He just lost it, lost discipline. If you can say somebody that like way, that, yeah. He's very disciplined, but if you put it that way. Yeah. And it was just the way that the Kennedy drew that out of him was, you know, it wasn't even forced. He wasn't even like going and asking, you know, what's up, you know, tell me about this. Tell me about your methods. Tell me about this. It was just, as we're IDing, you know, victim 17, here's how it, you know, and Dahmer just offers, this is where I spun, you know, this is, this was all my fault because I was drinking too much and this is, I just lost it. But they never forced any of it. So, I mean, the only part I did see that they were forced, and I wonder if you talked to Mr. Kennedy about this, but command staff really wanted to know what was with the bite marks and the filleted meat in his freezer. And there was tension between Kennedy and the other detective that were in the box, and command staff really wanted to know what the deal was and the cannibalism aspect. And did you guys ever specifically talk about that part? It wasn't a huge part of the book, but it was very, very tense because you're risking all of your rapport in going there. You don't know how that's going to react.
Right. You mean in terms of confronting Dahmer with this information that, you know, they knew he had been withholding, but they learned of it. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was, you know, like, because you're right. It was sort of a balancing act still. And I think because even though they had felt they gained this rapport with him and you know, after many weeks, they'd sort of, you know, established this and were feeling like they were on, you know, fairly solid ground. I think they also still knew just because of what they had learned about Dahmer in that time and that, you know, other people had told them about Dahmer was that, you know, this could be one of those points where he could just say, you know, I don't want to talk anymore. And that would be the end of it. And then they'd be kind of lost. And I think, you know, I think they were a little bit shocked and I think they have found it a little bit hard to even disguise that, you know, but I think that also was a turning point in a way because, you know, Dahmer said to them, well, I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want you, I didn't want to upset you. You know, I felt that would be too much and everything else I confessed, you know, was bad, but that the actual cannibalism would be something that you just wouldn't be able to deal with, you know? And so in a way he was kind of protective of the relationship he felt that he had gained, especially with Kennedy. But yeah, it's in terms of like, how are we going to bring this up? You know, how are we
And it was funny when it seemed like he didn't want to disappoint him, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Very much so.
Yeah, it was, but it was, and I can't remember if in the timeline, if that was the point where Kennedy just went in and started having lunch with the guy and just eased into that conversation. But yeah, I'll share my lunch with you. And tell me about the bicep in your freezer. I mean, exactly. But command staff basically was like, hey, you guys got to go figure this out. We got, you know, we can go with people making it up as we go, or we can actually document it. But it was interesting. And like I've been saying from the start, his professionalism and technique in handling this, and that was a risk to the rapport, like you said, that, you know, you never know what's going to set somebody off, especially if you can get over the fact that the guy has killed 17 people and is going to have a nice long discussion with a detective about it. Who knows what the thing is that can shut him down? So them balancing that, I thought wasn't a huge part of the book, but it was very important when you look at interview and interrogation.
Right. Well, I think it was a turning point in that once they got past it a little bit, in that the full truth was sort of known now in terms of, you know, what the ending was for some of his victims. You know, I think it was a relief, you know, probably to Dahmer, like, you know, like he might have thought, well, they might figure it out, but maybe not. And I don't know whether, I mean, I think he was just kind of biding his time, figuring that somebody was going to ask him about why he was keeping pieces of bodies in his freezer. And when they actually did talk to him about it, you know, it was sort of a chance to get that on the record and then also kind of get past it a little bit. And then it was almost a new level of honesty between them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you can hear that about somebody and then still say, you know, yeah, we can still talk, we can still be friends, we can still have a lunch together and then discuss the news or the coverage of your case, you know, like, yeah, then I think you'd feel like in Dahmer's case, he might have felt like he had a true friend here, that someone would be willing to sort of, you know, unconditionally want to spend some time with him.
Yeah, just accept. Yeah, you know, accepting as we go. I'm, you know, documenting it every step of the way, but being that lifeline every time. It was documented well in the book, the consequences of that. Did you guys ever talk about the, you know, what it meant to the family, to his private life, that kind of spiraled during this whole time?
In terms of Kennedy's personal life. Yeah. Well, I mean, as in the book a little bit, I didn't want to get too much into that because the focus was on his work as a detective. But I mean, obviously, this kind of a case is going to have an impact on your family, even if it's simply because of the hours away, you know, the hours that he was spending, interrogating Dahmer away from home, but also just in terms of the massive amount of media coverage, you know, and we can't imagine these teenagers seeing your dad's name, you know, and picture in the paper all the time associated with this case. And I mean, Milwaukee, I mean, it's a good sized city, but I mean, it's not a massive city. So, I mean, it had to have been dominating everybody's conversation at that time when all this was unfolding. And I mean, I think in his marriage, it was sort of a difficult time because, you know, Kennedy was sort of proud of the fact that he was able to talk to this guy and that he had built up this rapport and that, you know, he was actually getting the confession. He said, you know, I'm the guy's best friend, you know, like, this is wonderful in terms of, you know, using those interrogative skills and all the training that he had, you know, and actually being able to get this confession. His wife was really worried because she thought, oh my God, this is going to send you back to the bottle and maybe you should see a counselor or, you know, go and talk to somebody about this. I think his kids were sort of kind of fascinated a little bit, but he really didn't bring it up or talk about it at home. You know, it was kind of like, you know, you're not going to talk about Dahmer when we're having dinner, obviously, you know, where do you have questions? Yeah. But I mean, you know, I don't think he wanted to bring that much of the job into the home life, but there was a period of time where it was just so problematic, just in terms of how much focus there was on this case and on Dahmer, that his wife did say, you know, I'm just going to go to my mom's, take the kids with me, until some of this sort of dies down a little bit, because it's just becoming too problematic, you know, like it's affecting their school, it's affecting other things as well. So that's what happened. So they kind of sort of, you know, it wasn't a formal separation, but I mean, he was left on his own to finish off the dealing of the case and to get them through to the point of the trial. And then they all returned once, I guess, you know, he was convicted and sent off to prison. But inevitably that marriage did end. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it could have been any number of influences, but he did mention, he did mention in the book that, no matter how much time passed by, every now and then he'd still carry that with him, that he could blink his eyes and have that face staring at him from the fridge, those shocking moments sometimes don't always leave you. So he still carried pieces of that stress even long after, according to, you know, which is,
even in the night of our, you know, interview that we had, you know, the first and final time that I met him in person, you know, he said, I can actually still feel that same, you know, sensation, you know, anytime he had to relive that story of what he faced when he was, you know, suggested to him, open that fridge door. He said, I could actually, that fear he felt and that, you know, that uneasiness that he felt, like he said, you know, 30 years later, I can still kind of almost feel that feeling, like, so yeah, I absolutely never left him. And it was almost never allowed to leave him in a way, because, you know, after Jeff went to prison, you know, there was a lot of interest in the case still, people wanting to do documentaries and articles and programs about him. And so very often, especially while he was still on the force until 2001, Kennedy was, you know, always the go-to guy. Oh, well, you want to speak to Kennedy because he's the one that interrogated him. So he was often featured in these things and then sort of having to tell the story over and over and over again. And I mean, you know, he was sort of, you know, happy to tell it in a way, because it was kind of like, you know, it was a good case. We got this guy, you know, until, you know, before there was another victim potentially, and we stopped him, you know. There was a lot of things that came out of the case in terms of how he thought, and then eventually things were going to be done differently, you know, in terms of witnesses, you know, because if that case where the young Asian man got away And then the police brought him back up to Dahmer's apartment, which, you know, of course, was in the news and a lot of people know about. It was really kind of unfortunate because there was all these people around saying, you know, this isn't a man, this is a teenager. Yeah. He goes to my, you know, niece's school, you know, he's only like 14 or 15 years old, you know, and no, they were listening to Jeff who say, no, he's my boyfriend, he's of age, you know, come on upstairs, I'll show you his ID. And, you know, they chose to believe him, you know, so anyway, so a lot of stuff that came out of the case, he was more than happy to sort of promote, as you know, these are some of the things we learned from the Dahmer case. And yeah, you know, I mean, it sort of, after that night, you know, he was always kind of known as the Dahmer detective, and right up until the day he passed away.
Yeah, he was just kind of stuck. I mean, it was the price of, you know, everybody wants that case, you know, but there's a cost to it. You know, every detective in that bureau wanted to be the guy in the box with him. But, you know, like you said, years and years passed that you're still kind of prisoner to it. So there's a cost, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. But so yeah, you guys just captured every aspect of that working, you know, the professionalism of that particular detective was just on display right from the start during this book. And I think I thought that was a little more, maybe more powerful than, you know, than actually what they got out of Dahmer was, you know, just seeing this guy, you know, just take everything that he'd learned. And right from the start, as soon as the door shut on the interrogation room, he put it all into practice, and it was flawless. From getting him a cup of coffee, treating him like a human, giving him that lifeline that he stretched all the way through to conviction was, it's just the professionalism on display. It was just really, you guys captured it really, really well.
And I hope too that, you know, what kind of also came across was a little bit of even Kennedy's vulnerability, you know, and I don't know how he knew that this effect would be positive on this particular suspect, because he didn't know Dahmer, you know, that first night, you know, he's kind of their paths kind of crossed, and then all of a sudden they're in this room together talking, and you know, so he knows very little about this guy except for what he saw in the apartment. And the little bit that he was telling him, but, you know, he did at some point, you know, talk to him about his own alcoholism and how he treated it, and that he could relate to, why Jeff was probably using alcohol as an escapism, you know, and then, also when they started to talk about religion and God, you know, here's another side of, you know, Kennedy, and I don't know if this is in the training manuals about, you know, as you can start to tell the suspect things about yourself, because I don't think he would have done that like with any other person, but for some reason there was something in Dahmer that he felt like, you know, this is going to work on this guy, I think, and I think I can get to him this way, because these are obviously subjects that are important to him, and but I don't think it was, you know, like, I hate to use the word use, because it sort of seems as though, I don't know, you know, he was kind of using Dahmer, but at the same time, it's like, you know, Dahmer was convicted of a lot of crimes here, and maybe it doesn't matter, but I don't know. I just think, as you said, there was a respect, you know, I'm going to show you a little bit about my vulnerability, because you're showing me some of yours, you know, and then on this level, we can connect, maybe even on a little bit of an emotional level, you know, and I don't know how many detectives would have gone that way. I think a lot of them wouldn't want anyone like Dahmer to know that much about them. And as I said, I don't think it was something that he whipped out of his holster any time, you know, he wanted to. I think with this particular subject, he recognized something in Jeff. You know, there was something about Jeff that he felt that he could connect with him on much more than just, okay, you know, name, serial number, and rank, but just, you know, like the basic information, but real things about Dahmer in terms of his childhood and his upbringing, and, you know, the struggle he had with his sexuality, you know.
Yeah, especially during that time. I mean, you know, he made a point of saying that at one point. I mean, he knew right from the beginning that he was homosexual, but also as he grew, he just looked around society and said, much easier if I just keep it to myself, you know. And but when you, to your point of the you know, give and take, showing vulnerability, I mean, that's, communication's a two-way street. So you know, if you put up walls, anybody with any kind of perception is going to see that there, you just put up a wall, so that you just put up a barrier to this relationship we're building. But you're absolutely right. There are, how many people are actually comfortable enough to share personal details. That's a professional choice that probably a lot of people just have to make when they're put in that position. But you gotta find contact and you gotta find connection. But yeah, to go in and start talking, you know, show those kind of vulnerabilities, that's a personal choice. I think that those guys have to make. Mm-hmm. Yep. But it is, I don't want to keep you too long. It is a Saturday afternoon, but I want to, before we go anywhere, is there anything else out of Grilling Dahmer that you think we didn't touch on that the readers need to know about?
I don't want to give too much away, but at the same time, you know, it's one of these things, like I was talking about this with somebody else and they were kind of like, oh my God, you know, after all this time, what is there left to be said about this case? It's been documented, you know, other books have come out, you know, really, like, what is there more to say? And I sort of touched on it a little bit earlier, but I said, you know, like back then, in terms of what created this guy, I think that they are all things that we are sort of still faced with, you know, and I think it's just about kind of being able to identify some of these things in people and in behaviors and how we treat each other. I think the other thing I would just sort of point out, and you sort of mentioned it in terms of the time frame and this all occurring in 1991. And that's kind of like, you know, I think a lot of people who listen to podcasts or are into true crime nowadays, especially if they're looking back on crimes that are that old, you know, they have to kind of remember and kind of, if they can, well, they can't if they were not born yet, but I mean, they have to kind of get into that mindset of where law enforcement was, because, you know, they didn't have access to the DNA technology that we have now. I mean, they were just kind of getting into it a little bit, but in terms of like, well, why was it so important to get Dahmer to talk? Because they could have identified these victims, you know, lots of other ways. Well, not really, because first of all, you're talking about dismembered bodies, but you're also talking about a life or a time before DNA. So they had to kind of count on Dahmer to identify them and then for them to be able to go back and verify in terms of being able to identify those people. So they really did need Dahmer, you know, like, you know, so in terms of why did Detective Kennedy and the others kind of try and bend over backwards to kind of appease him in the beginning and to really want to gain that rapport, it really was because they needed him. They really needed him to talk. And I think, and I agree with you, that I think Kennedy just did a masterful job in doing that, you know, and sort of did it in such a way that Dahmer actually felt good about confessing.
So, yep. Yeah. He, when he got him on that, and I honestly, the last like 25 minutes, I've been like, man, I don't want to go too deep into this book because I don't want to give everything away. There's just so much great stuff to talk about. So yeah, I agree with you at the end of that. I got to leave some. Moving on next, are you still hanging out in the true crime world? What are you working on next?
I'm actually working on another book. It's not one case though. It's actually going to be a number of cases that I'm profiling. But the common thread or the common theme amongst them all is the idea of the family annihilator. So these usually men, but occasionally women, who basically like take out their entire families in one crime. Sometimes they commit suicide. Sometimes they try and get away with it. They stay behind and try and get away with it, blame somebody else. Sometimes they run. So I'm sort of doing a case, just very, very sort of short profiles on a number of these different kind of cases. And although it is a rare thing, thankfully, there are a number of cases when we go back in history that that deal with that. And, you know, for me, the idea of a family is, you know, the ones that are providing you support and comfort and love and all of those things. And it's just to me, like, how can these people turn on those people? And it's usually because, you know, they're tired of their life or some sort of financial thing has happened to them and they've lost everything and they feel like their family can't continue without that, you know, income or that level of income coming in. Sometimes it's another person, like another woman that's come into the picture. You know, they're just bored with their life and they want a new life. You know, there's all sorts of reasons. And so I'm kind of exploring the different reasons that those kind of cases occur.
When you wrap that one up, please come back and talk to me about it. that's fascinating.
You'll absolutely get a copy, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And this has been, it's great that we got to get together and talk about this. It's fantastic. You get, right from the start, when you mentioned that you gave, you know, Kennedy top billing on that, on the book and put yourself secondary, just very, very cool, way of honoring that guy. And I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate your interest in the book and the time that you gave today for us to talk. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody, before we sign off, thank you again to Robin. Grilling Dahmer on Amazon, pretty much any place you find the books. Also, audiobook is out. And before I cut out, I am also going to shamelessly plug that my first audiobook came out today on Tuesday. Not today. Ugh, screwed that one up. But Tuesday, my book, Blood Red Ivory audiobook through Wild Blue Press came out Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday the 3rd. And so far, thank you very much for the feedback. Outstanding narrator and Ramiz Monsef. Amazing job that guy did. So I hope to can't wait to hear what everybody thinks about it. And we will talk to you next week.